we will.
Yeah, all right, let's fine. Just we'll start
by saying that we is October 10th, 2008, and we're at the studio of Amy Fagan in New Salem, Massachusetts, to talk to you about your work with Illuminated Manuscript. You already told us this, but tell us again where you were born and raised.
I was born in Boston, Massachusetts, and I'm a Massachusetts native.
Okay. So you're known for your work in illuminated manuscripts.
Right.
I want to get to the Ketubah, but I want to just sort of go back in your life and tell us how you got into this whole field, because it's pretty unusual.
Well, let's see, it's really sort of a magic fairy tale story. As an artist, I, you know, made a series of decisions to make a commitment to make a living as a fine artist, and the two components that I had in mind was that I wanted to be an artist, and if I was going to be an artist, I wanted to make a living as an artist. And I did not have a formal education in fine arts outside of my own interests, which started, you know, in childhood. But after I was finished with graduate school, I started pursuing my interest in art and just exploring everything, and settled on interior decorative painting, which included floor cloths and furniture restoration and stenciling and wall treatments. And just explored that for a while because it was a practical way to be an artist and make a living. And at the same time, certainly studied all kinds of art history and became fascinated with the illuminated manuscript. And literally, you know, had an epiphany. You know, a little fairy basically came over to me and bing, you know, with the magic wand. Not verbally, but that was the level of draw, that recognition that, oh my goodness, this is what I know I can do. And it was as simple as that. So I simply started exploring the terrain of manuscript illumination, the history, and creating pieces that would move me ahead. And at the same time, there was an increasing interest in the Ketubah, which is this beautiful ceremonial art that is 2,500 years old and has been practiced continuously for that length of time. And I had a couple of requests from friends to make these illuminations for me, and that's how I got started commercially. So it just really expanded from there. And, you know, I'm very diligent and very organized and very disciplined, so, you know, I have always had that advantage in terms of focusing my energy.
back to the Ketubah, which is a very, very ancient tradition, prenuptial agreement. Tell us what it is. Mm-hmm. What is this?
It is a legal contract, and in its earliest stages, which I think some of the first Ketubah that have been found are roughly around 500 BC, but the first illuminated Ketubahs date back 2,500 years. So there's about a 500-year gap, if I did math right there. There's about a 500-year gap between the first written contract and contracts that were created with decoration. And they've been practiced every single generation. Every, you know, point in Jewish history, you'll find an example of a Ketubah if it's survived. So I'm carrying on this unbelievable tradition.
And what once a couple is married, it's usually displayed in the home?
Typically. Yeah. I mean, you know, it has such a varied history, and Jewish communities have had different relationships with the greater community that it hasn't always been advised to advertise your marriage. So they were folded up or secured. You know, the basic tenet is that it's the contract that binds you legally under Jewish law. So it was handled more as a legal contract.
I see. Mm-hmm.
But different periods of history have different flowerings of using these contracts as decorative art forms also.
Okay. So the one that's in the exhibition currently, can you tell us a little bit about that one? Is that your
That's
family?
Mine.
That's yours.
It's my Kitubo that I made with my husband. I mean, I did all the work, but we designed it together. Yeah. And the symbolism in it is fairly simple. It's actually created in an angular format. It's a parallelogram, and the language is written on an angle. And the adornment is a Native American poem, a Tiwa Indian poem that my husband had given to me, you know, really early in our courtship. Then we were breaking up, and he gave me this poem, and it just totally turned me around. And it's like a creed that I really live by on a day-to-day basis. And it basically just talks about living with honor and living with enough dignity that you're worthy of the life that you're living, in so many words. So that's on there, and the traditional conservative contract with the Lieberman Clause, which is an offshoot of the original Orthodox contract, which does allow men and women to seek a divorce if they needed to. It's really, you know, a modern women's lib contract. So that's on there. And then there's some visual symbols. There's two birds, one symbolizing me, one symbolizing Wayne, and then three jewels set into the corners. And the number three is a symbol of growth. Mm. So that's symbolism in that piece is pretty simple.
Yeah. the illumination.
Mm-hmm.
Is this using gold leaf or pigment? What do you use?
Well, the word illumination was coined in the 12th century to describe the application of gold leaf onto paper, which became a part of the scribes' tools that they would use to make books. And it's been extrapolated to include the entire genre. So it's a term that originated with just that one technique, but now it really describes the whole genre.
Yeah, the whole genre. Tell us, there's a piece right to the side of us that's framed. Oh, beautiful piece. Can you tell us about this?
Well, that piece is the second in the series that I'm completing that's entitled Beyond Genocide, where I use the illuminated manuscript to explore the terrain of the history of genocide and the legacy of the people that were that these terrible crimes were committed against. And at some point in my career and practice as a manuscript illuminator, I just simply, as I explained to you before, reached a level of maturity where I was able to sort of draw in all the tools where I could research the history, understand how to look at a whole group of people and how to express their identity through this incredible sacred art form. And so this piece here looks at the Armenian genocide, which was a mass atrocity which occurred beginning in 1915, and roughly 1.5 million Armenians were either executed or run into the desert by the Ottoman Turkish regime or empire towards the end of that empire. And the composition itself is based on two artifacts that I had researched in Armenian history. And just to back up a tiny bit, when I start looking at the how to create an illumination, I look at the atrocity, and then I go all the way back to the beginning of the history of the people. And some of these atrocities are modern. In this case, it's one of the first, or the first, of the 20th century. But the Armenian people's history dates back to the 3rd century AD. So they've got a long history and a very strong religious identity. So the composition is based on both the beautiful folk craft of tatting, or which you have an example of in
the Marash embroidery.
Embroidery.
And then you're right, the needle lace.
Needle lace.
Mm.
And also the footprint of the Church of Ani, which is one of the first churches that was built in this area of the world. And just in terms of the detail, you know, in the center there's the representational imagery, which is a view of Mount Ararat. Mount Ararat is the sacred place or location that Armenians identify with. In fact, Noah's Ark landed on Mount Ararat. You can find it right in the Old Testament. And the church structures are all based on the actual churches. This is the Ichmiadzin, which is one of the first churches that was built. I believe it was 309 AD. And these images here of these people wandering out of their villages is actually a rendering taken from a photography legacy that was taken by a German photographer, Armin Wegner, who really risked his life to document the evacuations of the villagers from their villages. So these are actual, you know, real renderings of the people, and I did get permission from his estate to use this work. And if you look around this center circle here, this is a portion of the Armenian Bible, which was translated from the Greek Bible. One of the origins of the identity of the people was in the formulation of the language in the 4th century. And one of the first books they translated was the Bible. And this is from the Old Testament, and the story that it tells is bone-chilling because it is a description of what these people are going through, and it talks about your bones being crushed by oppressors inflicting atrocity on you day after day. And it's a cry. It's from the Book of Lamentations, which is amazing that it reverberates, you know, from a 2,000-year-old document to the Armenian people to what happened, you know, to today. And
those
further
vessels,
outside, the little ceramic decorative elements of women that look like they're pregnant is based on a beautiful folk craft of making salt jars. And so these are actually very popular in 19th and 20th century Armenia, and I used that design shape. And inside of the bellies of the pregnant women are these cross shapes, and these cross shapes are based on another historic artifact from this part of the world called a khachkar. And what is so profound about how the composition evolved is that these women have pregnant bellies, and these are all Christian children, and it's really the Christian Armenians that were targeted. So it's very powerful.
And this figure, the hand
is based on a reliquary object that was found in one of the churches that is the symbol of peace. And, you know, I did hear a tale, and I did call the Armenian Museum and Library to find out a little bit more information about the detail of the hand, and they did tell me that the priest's hands were cut off as part of the, you know, terrorist campaign that was waged against him. I just heard that tale. I don't know whether it's true or not, so it does work nicely into the story. But that's how a composition evolves. So, and that's one of what is
this whole series.
Right.
Yeah. And so the original of this is where?
Right over there. And it's packed away.
Okay. So
I'm not going to display the originals until the whole piece
is
the whole series is finished.
And what process do you just describe that again about, let's say you've finished an original and you're going to reproduce it. How's it done?
Well, this is a G. Clay reproduction. So I finished the master. I have it scanned professionally, got a digital file, pop it into my computer. If I have to treat it at all, just to get it to be accurate color-wise.
Okay.
And then I make a print.
Yeah. It's a big print, though.
Yep, well, that's full scale. That's the size of the piece. I have a 44-inch printer, so I try to limit my work to 24-inch.
Yeah.
That's as wide as I'm going to go with these. And, you know, at some point when work is finished, I'd like to create a book. So, you know, then you shrink them down.
Yeah. It's stunning. And you were talking about heritage, or what is...
Well, this is the Kitsu books that I was telling you about that I've, you know, been creating for so many years. I've developed a really nice collection. So the collection has fallen into three categories. I have a contemporary category, which is really my trademark. And right now, you can see here, I'm just starting a composition on an original commission, which will actually eventually be a print. So, you know, it's a pretty basic composition. It's called Double Ring, but it's got a really nice orbital, you know, heavenly kind of a feel to it, which a lot of my work does. But I'm just starting with the rapidograph, and I'll fill in with the color later. And then this piece here is based on the Heritage series, which I look at either in explicitly or metaphorically a part of Jewish history. So in this case, I had the opportunity to travel to Sarajevo, Bosnia-Herzegovina, a couple of years ago. And this design is based on a beautiful embroidery that I had found on a wall on display. So it's a fairly simple composition, but when I create the pieces and put the text inside, I will give the couple that purchases the ketubah a little window into the history of the that part of the world. So this one's based on the
Venice.
Right. So we'll do the same thing for Sarajevo.
Mm-hmm. And where do you get, you've been doing this many years, about how many ketubahs have you done, do you think, and sold? Roughly
thousands. Yeah.
And how do people find you?
I have a series of galleries all around the country that represent me. I also have a website. So both things.
But this field, this you're saying is your commercial work, and the other is your fine art work. I mean, how do you
feel?
Well,
you know, it's all fine art, but the genocide project is such a big commitment, and it requires an enormous amount of research to genuinely represent a group of people that I, at you know, the beginning, know nothing about, and I, you know, want to make sure that I pay tribute to these people who've suffered so much. You can't play around with that kind of responsibility. So with 25 compositions and 3 to 6 months worth of research to even just figure out the composition, it's a lifelong commitment. It's an adult life commitment.
Yeah.
So I've been able to put them on display. I told you I started the exhibition work in 2005. I had 4 pieces finished. Every time I finish a piece, as soon as I get enough money together, I frame it. And when I have the energy, I'll find a grant, put the exhibition together, and it's really grown, you know, above and beyond what I myself have done. But I just want to show you, I've got 2 other probably examples of other genocide pieces, just so that you could have a chance to peek at them. These are little renderings, but...
Oh, that looks like Ethiopia.
Yep, that's right. How'd you know that?
Because I met an Ethiopian iconographer.
Oh, you're kidding!
No. I mean, well, he does Ethiopian iconography, and his name is Christopher Gosney, and he lives in New Hampshire now.
And so this looks like...
Pegged it right to the... That is incredible.
Well, the face, it just...
Sure.
It's absolutely based on the history of... You know, Ethiopia had a huge portion of its history that was devoted to manuscript illuminations.
Yeah.
Hundreds of examples.
Beautiful. And it looks Celtic, too. And I remember saying that to him, and him saying about some connection.
No, I didn't read about any connection. The neat thing about this particular illumination, which was a big challenge, and you wouldn't necessarily know it to look at it, was finding this Amharic poetry based on the oral history of the Gojam district. I just happened to... I searched for Amharic writing, and I had really luckily found this one book. It's almost impossible to find anything in Amharic in this country. You go to the National, well, not the National Archives, but the Smithsonian, and they won't let them go. So,
and did you hand letter that?
Yes.
Wow.
Yeah. And this is actually, this part of the composition is based on some of the metallic staffs that are very, very popular in the processional ritual activities. It's based on a piece of metalwork, so I used the decoration for that, and the 4 saints are you know, this is, oh, I can't remember their names. I can't remember the names off the top of my head. But saint worship and reverence is very important. This is the Queen of Sheba, Mary, is one of the more modern Islamic saints. And these guys are just based on little illuminations that I have found. And one of the things about the atrocity that was so prevalent, it's similar to the Zimbabwe issue that you were talking about, it was politicized. So the political opponents of Haile Mariam Magisu were mostly the young elite. And they were either murdered and stacked up on the side of the road, or they had, you know, had to flee their country. So it was really this the future of the entire country that was
so have you done the Khmer Rouge?
In Cambodia, yes. Cambodia was the third piece that I finished. That's downstairs in the front.
Oh, okay.
I can show you. I have a small piece. Wow. And this one looks at Hiroshima and Nagasaki, which is not really, doesn't fall under the category of genocide in the sense that it wasn't a group of people that were targeted for elimination because of religious, ethnic,
No, it was just war.
Right, exactly. It was a result of a war. But the weapon was the subject matter. And the fact that just absolute annihilation could happen in a fraction of a second was a turning point for humanity. And so I really felt like I had to look at it carefully. And the composition is based on, it's a very abstract composition. It's based on the remnants of a movie theater where just the iron shell, the melted iron shell remains, and so this portion of the composition is based on that. And then there were lots of eyewitness testimonies of what the bomb looked like. And I found this gorgeous small piece of Japanese embroidery with essentially this design that looked like what the descriptions were. And so that's how that played into to that, and the rendering of the floating river is basically the concept of renewal, because if you go to Hiroshima or Nagasaki today, they're thriving cities. So, you know, and they were obliterated within a 2-mile radius. Nothing survived. And the poem is written by a survivor who, it's a very gruesome poem. It basically talks about her experience shoveling the dead bodies, and, you know, being exposed to radioactivity, and it's really ugly. So, you know, I wanted that contrast between.
And how do you deal with? I mean, your art is dealing with such ugliness. How do you get by?
I mean, you know, it makes a lot of sense, because, you know, aside from my visual, you know, devotion to this work, I also talk with people who are doing all kinds of aspects of genocide, policy, education, prevention, and, you know, it's still a raw, open wound. And this really is incredibly healing, because it looks at, with total sympathy, you know, not sentimentality, but real sympathy for what this group of people would have wanted to say to you if they were able to tell you, this is what happened to me, this is what I want to explain. And, you know, there's a real leap of faith there, you know, as to whether me, who knows, has never lived through this kind of experience and really doesn't know what would have been like to go through that, you know, I'm hoping I can make that gap and really help somebody else who doesn't have that knowledge about the history of these people.
And have you shared this with an Ethiopian or the Armenian with an Armenian?
I don't dare put the calligraphy down there without all kinds of scholarly.
No, I didn't mean that. I meant, how does it feel to them, you know, to see?
I think that people are just amazed. You know, every one of the atrocities is so different, and people come from different walks of life. So that, you know, if I have the opportunity to speak with a survivor on one level or another, whether it's interviewing them the way you're interviewing me to learn more about their life. It's really hard to say. I think it's, you know, every individual brings their own life experience with these things. And most people are so grateful that I'm even doing this, you know, because a lot of these stories you know, who do you know knows about the Ethiopian, you know, massacres of the, you know, 1970s and 1980s?
No,
it's not a well-known
no.
point. So,
well,
you know, and I'm learning all the time, too. I mean, I'm not a historian, so it's, you know, for me to, it's a challenge for me to even convey the information mm-hmm. and remember everything. And like, you know, just the one saint name doesn't always come to my forefront of my mind, but it's all there in the panels, mm-hmm. and people can sort of take and leave whatever they want.
And did you have art training? Did you go to art school?
No, I didn't. I'm self-taught.
You're self-taught.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. But I mean, you know, it was like I told you that little...
Yeah.
You know, the little fairy came right up and bonk.
That's great.
Me, you're going to be a manuscript illuminator.
Yeah.
And I literally, I mean, that was it. You know, that little epiphany happened, and I've been, you know, totally devoted for almost 30 years now. I know. So that's the story of Tubas and the genocide pieces.
Let me see if there's anything else. Gabriel Montfort-Cadis.
Oh, that's the saint?
Yeah. Remember that?
Can you think of anything that you'd like to ask?
This is something I know absolutely nothing about.
I know very little about it.
Right. Well, you know, the one thing that I, you know, I'm hoping is that because I started out as a layperson with no knowledge of any of these atrocities, that, you know, the trajectory and the commitment that I've made, I can shorten someone else's
learning curve.
Learning curve. So, yeah. And it's that, and you know, it's the visceral part. It's like, you know, imagine being a kid from Uganda or, you know, somewhere where you don't speak English. Are they going to get it? You know, I really want somebody who just doesn't know anything about these people. I just want them to be able to get it. So the text panels can be translated into any language.
Okay.
You know, you can sort of size it up or down educationally.
Right. I think you should exhibit at the UN.
I'm sure, you know, it'll have its whirlwind tour at some point in time.
Yeah.
It's getting out there.
Yeah.
I keep forgetting the name of the Jewish...
Ketubah.
Now, Gentiles. Do they come to you? I'm just wondering who has this done. And anyone can come?
Well, the Ketubah itself is a document that follows Jewish law. Mm-hmm. So if you're not Jewish, technically, you're not going to buy a ketubah.
Right.
But there's such an incredible interest in the art form that I definitely have people
That's
from
what
all
I'm wondering.
Walks of
aesthetically,
life
people are drawn to
yeah.
it.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. And I do sell, you know, non-traditional ketubah and wedding contracts, like this one right here.
Oh. Yes,
yeah,
that would be.
What
so
is the price range of these?
Well, the prints are like $250. Mm-hmm. It's $65 for us to personalize them.
Yeah, right, because it's personalized. So I get it. Yeah.
So I have a little series of international vows.
That's great.
Yeah.
And so you're a great calligrapher.
Well,
this is not, but some of the other stuff.
Okay,
calligrapher. What did you say?
I wouldn't say calligraphy. If I was in a school of illuminators, you know, before we
lost
our...
Tell us.
Before, well, you know, it's up until the 14th century, one person did not make these beautiful illuminated books.
There was someone doing the text.
Right. Someone did the painting, someone did the figures, someone did the landscape, mm-hmm. someone did the calligraphy, someone did the gessoing, someone did the gold leafing.
Right.
I wouldn't probably have been the calligrapher.
No, you wouldn't, but you're doing it all.
Yeah.
You're
well,
having
it's
it
modern, I'm using it as a modern
mm-hmm.
art. You explore people who do traditional arts. This is a traditional art, but I am totally committed to making it a modern art.
Right.
Yeah. Because we've advanced our, you know, our
Oh, absolutely. I mean, there are, I just interviewed this letterpress printer who's still casting type in metal. You know, here he's using all the traditional, but there's all different ways of going about
right.
it and
right.
you know, keeping
right.
some things and not others.
Right. But it's that power of the sacred, you know, you mm-hmm. really, we very, very little really approach the sacred. You know, we get glimpses of it, you know, when you're standing in front of a magnificent landscape, but even when it comes to art objects, just mm-hmm. when you have that sacred intent, it really makes you step back and yeah. say, okay, you know, who was this huge group of people? And you get some little glimpse as to what does it mean when a million people mm-hmm. yeah. are murdered. Okay.
Absolutely. I mean, there are. I just interviewed this letterpress printer who's still casting type in metal. You know, here he's using all the traditional, but there's all different ways of going about
right.
it, and
right.
you know, keeping
right.
some things and not others.
Right. But it's that power of the sacred. You know, you mm-hmm. really, we very, very little really approach the sacred. You know, we get glimpses of it. You know, when you're standing in front of a magnificent landscape, but. Even when it comes to art objects, just mm-hmm. when you have that sacred intent, it really makes you step back and yeah. say, okay, you know, who was this huge group of people? And you get some little glimpse as to what does it mean when a million people mm-hmm. yeah. are murdered. You know?
Now I'm really curious to see your Holocaust, your Jewish Holocaust.
That's my next
You haven't
one.
Done that one yet.
No, I'm just finished mm-hmm. Hiroshima and Nagasaki.
I have the portfolio. Oh, here it is.
Just so you can see
yeah,
the little,
just get a sense
little
of it.
Window, little wise here.
Oh,
there's
your
list.
Okay.
So I've finished Afghanistan, Armenia, Bangladesh, Cambodia, China, Crusades and Inquisition, DRC, Ethiopia, Hiroshima and Nagasaki. So I'm just starting to look at the Holocaust now.
Wow.
And so here's Afghanistan, and I won't go into all the detail, but there's a really funny story. I've been able to work with an anthropologist at Williams College who specializes in Afghan history, and he gave me this book that he wrote called Before the Taliban, and he was in Afghanistan right during that whole era where the Mujahideen were uprising against the Soviet forces, and he's got this picture of an Afghan with a big red beard who's holding a sword. He looks exactly like this guy. And this is a relic from the Greek era where Alexander the Great sort of traipsed through this whole region and left Greek garrisons. And this is a bronze, a detail of a bronze sculpture from a solder play. So it's just so funny how these things reverberate through history.
Yeah.
And
those look like Hindu.
They do.
Well, Buddhist India also, between the 7th and the 3rd and the 10th century, was pretty much manifested itself in most of that part of the world. And you probably heard of the Buddhas of Bamiyan. Those big 200-foot sculptures. Oh, they were a World Heritage Site.
Mm.
In
Afghanistan.
In Afghanistan, they're called the Buddhas of Bamiyan. Bamiyan Valley is a valley in Afghanistan that had a Buddhist monastic center, and these 200-foot low relief carved figures were in the face of a mountain, and they were obliterated by the Taliban. It took them a week to bomb these. But it was, you know, it would be like bombing, you know, the Statue of Liberty or... Even longer,
yeah.
This is a whole era of Afghan history. But this looks at the Mongol invasions in the 13th century, and also the modern invasion of the Soviet Union originally. Mm-hmm. I won't go into more detail with that one, but you saw Armenia. Now this one looks at Bangladesh in 1971. Bangladesh was East Pakistan, and after the Western Pakistani army did a 130-day massacre where 400,000 women were raped, and 10 million refugees later, it became a nation. And this history goes back, you know, a couple of thousand years, but all the way back to the beginning of the Buddhist era. And this is Cambodia. This one looks at Cambodia. And, you know, one caveat is these beautiful little black and white photographs or renderings of photographs came from the Tuol Selang prison, which was the biggest prison and torture center in Phnom Penh. It was an elementary school, but they took pictures of the people that came into the prison, and I think they said only 7 people survived out of the 147,000 that were incarcerated there. And then this one looks at China, 100 years of Chinese history after the fall of the last emperor and 9/11 and the rise of the communist and nationalist forces, the Japanese invasion, where you've probably heard of the rape of Nanking. You can see this woman down there, the detail. What's very powerful about this particular illumination is when you sort of first look at it, it looks very lovely.
Yeah.
And then as you start sort of looking closer, you know, there's a lot of little gruesome scenes there. But the Japanese were merciless, and they, you know, they estimate, you know, up to 70 million people in China were killed during that 100-year period. And this is based on the Analects of Confucius, and it's basically like the Golden Rule, and it basically says, don't do to others what you don't want forced upon you.
Mm-hmm.
But that's, you know, the Confucian ideology permeates Chinese culture. Mm-hmm. And this looks at the Crusades and the Inquisition. And this is the story of Cain and Abel,
mm-hmm.
told both mm-hmm. in the Old Testament and the Quran.
It's called.
Mm-hmm. And I mean, they're so detailed, it takes a half an hour to really
mm-hmm.
look at all of the choices that I had made to express the atrocity. Now, this is the Democratic Republic of the Congo, which had 2 big periods of history where people were killed for one reason or another. There was the Belgian era where King Leopold much was responsible for the death of approximately 10 million Congolese. And then the era of Mobutu Sese Seko, which was a 30-year reign of terror where he sort of picked claim the rest of the resources of that area. So it's a very modern
mm-hmm.
piece, and there's still, you know, a lot of conflict in that area.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. And then once you showed
yeah.
saw
yeah.
Ethiopia,
really
Hiroshima.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's
incredible work.
Thank you.
So that's the scoop.
Yeah.
Thank you for listening.
Oh, sure. Can I just...
Diet.
Well, I don't know if I should photograph because
should
I won't get...
Photo?
Yeah.
I have postcards.
That-